Hello, and welcome to the 21st Rewrite, the podcast about screenplays and the process of writing them. I'm William Coldwell, and this week I have another solo screenplay breakdown episode for you, and similar to the last episode of this type on the film Lock, I'm going to try to link the techniques used in the screenplay to some larger lessons and writing advice, so you can learn from the podcast and hopefully consider some ideas that you might find useful in your own writing. This week's topic is one I'm very excited to talk to you about, as it's one of my favorite films of the last few years, 1917, written by Sam Mendes and Christy Wilson-Cairns. So this is now the third of this new episode type where it's just me talking to you, the listener, directly, and I believe that the best way is to give these a name now to categorize them, and so I'm going to be calling these writer's workshops. So if these are the kind of episodes that you like, do look out for them on the podcast feed. They're going to be known as writer's workshops from this point forward, and they're really going to be an opportunity to take a certain screenplay, see what it can teach us, consider how it became such a great film, or where it might have failed. The episodes I've done previously are on Artificial Intelligence, the 2001 film of Steven Spielberg, and as I just mentioned, also the episode, the last one I released was on Lock. I really hope that you're enjoying this new episode type. If you have any feedback, if you have any comments, if you'd just like to share your enthusiasm for the show, there are two places that you can join me right now that are platforms that I really want to focus on. One is, of course, the podcast's Instagram. The account is at the 21st Rewrite, and you can just follow and join the group there. And the alternative, and one that I'm really, really excited about at the moment as well, is Syncify, which is a podcast player that also has social media features integrated, so you can join a community, find other listeners, comment on the episodes, you can add timestamps, you can ask me questions, and I'll be really happy to get back to you and share my thoughts. So either of those two options are available for you, and I really hope to hear from you. Now, one of the ways I thought would be fun to kick off most of the Writers' Workshop episodes is by answering a question. And this week's question is a really interesting one, and I think that I can actually provide quite a lot of insight into. And that is, why should you join a writer's group? I'm a member of a writer's group. I find it really, really helpful. It's a really fun time getting together with other screenwriters, taking a look at what we're working on, sharing our thoughts and opinions on some pages that we're reading that day. We get a really interesting range of ideas and topics, from comedy to drama and film, TV, and all kinds of things, shorts and comics as well. And at the end of the day, it's just really great to not be in a bubble, not be isolated. Especially as a writer, you know, it's such a solitary pursuit at times, but film and TV in particular are such collaborative mediums that having the feedback from your peers and people who share an interest and really want to see you develop and become the best writer that you can be, it's a really great thing. However, I've had a really deep think about it in response to this question, and I've boiled it down to five reasons which I think make a really great case for joining a writer's group. So, reason number one is to get out of your comfort zone. I know this from personal experience. As a writer, you can be working in this solitary manner, and it can be quite daunting to have written something and then show it to a group of people. And so by joining a writer's group where everyone is going to have to do the same thing, everyone is going to have to put their work forward to the scrutiny of the group, and it can be this terrifying experience, I think, especially for some people who are really more nervous. And what you'll find is it's a really encouraging space where everyone actually wants you to share your work, and you'll be really surprised by the reaction that you'll get from different people. So facing your fears is always something that can have a positive benefit that can lead to positive change, and it can begin by just finding like-minded people who have the same mindset, who have the same goal, and will work with you in achieving that goal. Tip number two is quite related. That's get used to hearing constructive feedback. Now, when you put your writing out to the scrutiny of an audience, of course, you're probably going to hear good things and bad things, negative and positive. But when you hear feedback from other writers, they're people who understand your language. They understand what you're trying to do, and they're going to try and find ways that help you get the best out of what you're writing. even though this is kind of related to point one, you know, getting out of your comfort zone, you might hear some constructive feedback that hurts. But I feel that, honestly, some of the feedback that you'll hear, if you feel that it is true, then it's a good sign that it might be something you actually did want to change. And you just maybe were waiting to hear it from someone else as well, in order to really be sure that it was time to change that part. Of course, you do want to find a group of writers who are not wholly negative and do want to find the best for you. So, of course, there is a difference between constructive feedback and just criticism. And I'll talk a little bit about that, I think, at the end of this segment. But moving into point number three here is, it's an opportunity to hear your words read out loud. This is a really amazing thing, especially for aspiring writers who want to work in the dramatic part of writing, whether that's theater, film, television, short films, even like YouTube programs, things like this. The opportunity to hear other people read your words out loud and to hear how they deliver those sentences, how they interpret the words on the page, you can see if you're being clear with how you're writing by how you hear it read back to you. And also, as you get to know the people in your group, of course, you're going to find that different people have different strengths, different styles of comedy sometimes, different styles of delivery, and you're going to have a really great time by doing that and hearing your words read out loud. Reason number four is being able to look back on your progress and see others develop. One of the great and probably the most rewarding parts of being in a writer's group is actually seeing other people develop and seeing the feedback that you might have given on something that they wrote actually being incorporated into their writing when they bring those same pages in, rewritten in the future. Of course, this podcast is called The 21st Rewrite. The belief is that rewriting can fix, can improve, can make things better. Things are not always perfect after the first draft. Sometimes you can take in outlines, you can take in ideas to workshop, as well as the actual screenplay pages and hear them being read out like that. You can also kind of do a pitch and hear what people think of the idea before you get into writing it, or see if your outline is working. So there's lots of other ways you can see yourself develop and different avenues that you can explore as part of the group. And reason number five, of course, is the most important one, just on a personal level. That's making new friends and trusted contacts. It's so great to get together with people who share your interests, and often writers find that some of their closer friends or members of their family, for example, don't really understand writing as an art, or it's not something that they're particularly interested in. And that doesn't mean that they're any less great as friends or family members or any less supportive. It just means that sometimes you might find other people who you connect with better on that level when you join a specialist group that is specifically about writing. So finally, just to kind of sum up, I hope these five reasons kind of inspire you if you have been considering to join a writer's group at some point in the future. And I'm just going to go back to something that I said about maybe hearing maybe too much negative feedback or maybe not connecting well with people. In essence, joining a group is a little bit like dating. You might not meet the people who are right for you on the first try, but if you keep looking, eventually you'll find some people who you connect with. And so also don't let a negative experience change your mind about how writers' groups might actually operate, because essentially these groups are basically as good as the people that make up each group. And certain people become friends in life and other people don't connect, and that's just a normal part of how humans interact. But if the goal is going to be, and is explicitly stated, and everyone agrees that the goal is to help each other develop, to share ideas, to be tolerant, to encourage each other, then hopefully it's going to work out for everyone involved. So, well, I hope you enjoyed this segment. How about we take a very quick break now, and then when we come back, we'll talk about 1917. So, welcome back. On the last Writer's Workshop episode, I mentioned that the next screenplay that I wanted us to look at together would be 1917. And I think this is going to allow us to explore the differences between the concept of single location, as we saw with Locke, and a film designed to be told with a single shot. And what I mean by that is that 1917 simulates only having one camera follow the protagonists from beginning to end. And there is no cutting away. It is as if it was one shot. Now, 1917 actually just simulates this because it's a very, very expensive and risky thing to try and do an entire film as one shot. But the idea is essentially that it would be told from one camera, one perspective, following the action from beginning to end in real time. Now, on the surface, these differences between a single location and a single shot might seem completely self-evident to you, but I hope that as we begin to get deeper into the comparison, it will become clearer what each format can teach us, and we'll also be able to see the bridges that link both approaches in order to better understand universal storytelling, alongside the unique creative opportunities offered by each. Now, some people feel that the single shot, or one-er, is a bit of a gimmick, and often when you do see negative reviews of 1917 or similar films, they often boil down to personal taste and a dislike of the one-shot structural framework. Over the course of this episode, I hope to offer a rebuttal to these criticisms. So, 1917, just to remind you, was released right at the end of 2019, just after the 4 years of centenary events remembering the sacrifice and loss of World War I. And it really was a world war. It not only affected an entire generation across Europe, but it also drew in combatants from across the world, Asia, Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and more. Alfred Mendes, for example, Sam Mendes' grandfather, whose experiences served as the initial inspiration for the screenplay, was himself from Trinidad. It took him almost a lifetime to open up again, and it was when he was in his 70s that Alfred told his family about how he had been tasked with crossing No Man's Land to deliver a message during the war. He was reasonably short-statured, at 5.5 foot tall, and so he was able to stay within the 6 feet of cover afforded by the mist. In 1917, the story is about two English soldiers, both still youths, who are tasked with delivering a message in order to prevent 1,600 other soldiers from being led into a trap after the Germans feign a retreat, instead strategically moving back to the new Hindenburg line. Our main characters are Tom Blake, portrayed by Dean Charles Chapman, and Will Schofield, portrayed by George Mackay. Thus, the story is about a race against time, a journey that must be made through essentially uncharted and hostile territory, a burden of responsibility upon these two young men that is a literal matter of life or death for many others. Mendes wrote the screenplay in collaboration with a young and extremely talented screenwriter from Glasgow, Christy Wilson-Cairns, and ultimately it received a nomination for the Best Original Screenplay at the Academy Awards. So what we have here is an accomplished director with the opportunity to assemble all of the resources to attempt such an ambitious project, plus the personal connection and responsibility to remembrance that is particularly present during the centenary. Wilson-Cairns travelled along the Western Front with her mother while researching the film herself, and she said, "I was reminded how many mothers came to France in 1919 onwards. All those cemeteries were built for mothers and wives. All these beautiful memorials were built for the women, really. I'm 32. I don't feel particularly old. And I found that every cemetery I was in, I was older than every person buried there." So, the big idea I want to explore in this week's writer's workshop is, why should you consider writing a film that would be shot in a single take? What can this structure do for your story? What are the trade-offs and the unique benefits? In order for us to look into the answers to these questions, we're going to have to take a step back here. Suspend your disbelief for a second about the fact that 1917 had a budget of $95 million. Ignore the fact that Roger Deakins, widely regarded as the best cinematographer in the business, was in charge of the cameras, and that Sam Mendes is an Oscar-winning director who had been at the helm of two Bond films in the lead-up to this. There is no budget to writing. There is no price tag on your vision. That is a practical decision for later. This story, starts in a field where two young men are resting. From the writer's perspective, far more important is to think about how to get from place to place in sequence, how to get from that field onto the journey that these characters are going to go on. A one-shot film is essentially one long sequence. And so we're going to be thinking about how do you draw your audience into your story under this framework. 1917 could be put on as a play in an amateur theater in a small town and follow a similar story. Sequential dramatic storytelling can express itself in many forms, but it all begins on the page. I guess what I mean by that is that a screenplay is essentially a document to coordinate, and so by coordinating the actors and everyone else involved, you can retell that story. Coordination is essential, and it could be told in different forms, not just as a film. But just in case, if the fact that this is a film that had such a huge budget is weighing on your mind, and you're asking, why am I talking about this as an option of something we should be writing, I might also draw some parallels and comparisons with two other prominent 21st century films that use the same one-shot technique, but were made at different budgetary levels. So there's Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, by Alejandro González Iñárritu, and Victoria, by Sebastian Schipper. I won't give you any spoilers for either of these. If you haven't seen them, I highly recommend them. And this is the perfect point, actually, to make a distinction between two alternatives in storytelling here, because 1917 follows specifically two characters from beginning to end, whereas Birdman follows multiple characters, and thus the camera seems to wander off and focus its attention on different subjects from time to time. And this is actually one of the ways that stream of consciousness literature has also used, especially in the modernist style in the 1920s, that you could kind of drift from character to character in this kind of seamless manner. So that's the kind of approach that Birdman takes, whereas 1917 or Victoria both follow their primary protagonists. Both can be considered one-shot films, or at least to simulate this effect. Victoria, out of all of these, Victoria is the only film that was actually completely done in a single shot. But of course, today I just want to look specifically at the type of story that we see with 1917, which is when we have a single camera, sequential story, following in real time the journey of its protagonists all the way through. So the next question really to address is, why is this even considered a gimmick? Why is it so strange to even be considering shooting a film in a single shot? Well, it's largely because the language of film developed around the cut. So shooting an entire feature film was always expensive and risky, and you would want to be able to have multiple takes. And the technology was limited in the length of the reel of film, so that even when Alfred Hitchcock made Rope in 1948, which is supposedly a one-shot film, but is actually made up, kind of like 1917, by 10 cuts edited together, occasionally trying to simulate it in a seamless manner and occasionally actually drawing attention to itself, it was technically impossible for Alfred Hitchcock's crew to actually have even shot the film in a single take. And that's not even to mention the fact that the coordination involved, the high expense, the amount of risk, the fact you need your cast and crew to not make a single mistake during the entire execution of the project is generally seen as a good reason not to attempt the one-shot take for the entire film. However, what I'm trying to talk about here is really about the type also that is used by Birdman as well as 1917, which simulates what it's like to follow an entire story with a single camera in real time, whereas the actual risk of doing the entire thing in one night, as Victoria did to great success, might be a risk too far for many filmmakers. But anyway, cutting from scene to scene, from camera angle to camera angle, has become such a fundamental part of how we experience film, how we experience television, and any other kind of video medium right now, that to try to tell a single story with the single camera following the action gets accused of being a gimmick. Which is quite strange when you think about it, because we experience life as a single, uninterrupted, long take from only one point of view. It's actually a very human thing and something that you might expect that we would relate to. But this type of storytelling is actually often seen as unnecessarily restrictive. So in many ways, that idea of restriction should be buried into the very framework of the story. Birdman, Victoria, Rope, and 1917 all make their cases for why you should feel restricted when you watch them. Think back to Alfred Mendes crossing No Man's Land in the fog in winter. He would have experienced that entire journey, step by terrifying step, in an uninterrupted, claustrophobic walk. Snipers potentially aware of where he was without him even knowing. No cutting ahead, just two choices. Fight or flight. Keep going or freeze. That example alone should make it clear why Sam Mendes decided that this was the way to tell this story. Again, part of the problem with one shot is that it seems to some people that it's on rails. But that can mean two things, because all films are actually on rails. You start them again, and they play out exactly the same each time. They're not video games, they're not interactive, you can't go and do something different each time around. But maybe with the one-shot technique, you actually notice the rails more. It draws attention to itself. But then, that also makes you more aware that you, like the characters, are trapped on the same journey. It's the connection between you and your avatar that is implicit in your watching of a one-shot film, especially 1917. You might even call it your participation in 1917. The promise of the cut is that you can cut away to something else. You can escape this bond with the characters. You can find salvation and freedom from the reality that that particular character is facing. To know that this has been taken away is powerful in itself. Okay, so yes, screenplays that are wider, that have a variety of characters, perspectives, and experiences, that cut from place to place, forwards and backwards in time, offer juxtaposition and conflicting dramas, can cover completely different ground. But in the protagonist-driven, single-shot screenplay, the connection between the audience and the protagonist take on a new form. And that is probably the most important thing about Blake and Schofield. They are composites of what we recall of the war, what we have been told, what its legacy and mythology have bequeathed to us. They shall not grow old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn, as Binion wrote. Or Wilfred Owen, what passing bells for these who die as cattle. They are the unknown soldier, one and all, the scale of the loss and destruction of the First World War being such that it was only comprehensible as a collective metaphor. The similarity of experience, the horror that is implicit in knowing that. Just in terms of my own family history, I know the brothers of two of my great-grandfathers died within about 15 miles of each other on the Western Front. And this is just such a common experience that these men would have had no idea that in some future they would have been connected into the same family. But it was such a universal experience for British, Belgian, German, all kinds of European nations who basically just sent hundreds of thousands of men to their deaths in this war, and the legacy of it is still very much with us today and has very much shaped our view of Europe and the world, and our belief about war as well, and how we remember it was very much formed during this time. Yet one doesn't need to have a family connection to World War One. Sam Mendes intended for this film to be accessible to an audience that knows next to nothing about the war, and the concept of the unknown soldier really does play a prominent part in doing so. From Odysseus in Homer to Inman in Cold Mountain, the idea of the universal protagonist occurs again and again in storytelling. In Victoria, it's a young Spanish woman, and it still uses the same technique. We step into someone's shoes, follow their journey, and be with them in their highs and lows, elation and loss, and experience change along the way. So 1917 begins, as I mentioned, in a field, with Blake and Schofield getting some rest. Now, the screenplay opens with some interesting quotations, and I'm actually going to save those for the end as a kind of reward for listening to all of this podcast, and thank you in advance if you do make it that far. But I'll just start now with the actual story so we don't get taken off track. The beginning is almost in medias res. It's so fast to declare its premise. A sergeant appears, and he wakes Blake, and he says, "Pick a man, bring your kit." And just like that, the journey begins. That's a great writing tip just there in itself. Try and hook us quick and don't dally about. Some people think that that also is a little bit of a gimmick, but I would say that it can be a real incentive to a reader to keep reading, is when they're already finding something of interest on that first page. Although there is a benefit also to when you do a gradual build up and set the scene very well, and then start to release some of the more interesting aspects of the work. And I think with a film screenplay in particular, you get about 10 pages to do that, to set the scene. But of course, if you want to hook them quick, then it really does have its benefits. And I think it works really well, for example, in a film like this, that's going to be this on rails kind of action adventure from beginning to end. So let's think about pacing and tempo then, as a continuation of this. The rules that are created by this structure, the one-shot structure, you might remember how I mentioned in the last Writer's Workshop episode that rules or restrictions can provide a framework in response to the open-ended nature of creativity. It's a way of getting around writer's block. And just by saying that this is going to be a one-shot film, you've created some very strong rules to follow. Over the course of this episode, we're going to see some of the innovative ways that 1917 works around its own restrictions. But first, we're going to consider how they work as a narrative machine. You might have seen the tagline to 1917, "Time is the enemy." As a sequential film, trapped in the lens of a single camera's point of view, time can make the story both exciting and also be an obstacle in its own right. Every beat of the story, every moment of action, by necessity, has to head into the next one. It has to provide a transition from place to place. In some respects, that is true of most stories, but the average film will jump about from scene to scene with a far looser relationship. Here, there is an unbroken chain of actions, movements, and event that, by necessity, must lead into the following one. The result can be this very powerful contrast that we get between indoors and outdoors, bright and dark, nature and ruin, as the characters move through these elements seamlessly. There's so much planning involved in writing like this, but it's rewarding for both the writers and the audience. It goes back to that earlier word that we do not use so much anymore, but sometimes is more apt than screenwriter, which is playwright, W-R-I-G-H-T, write meaning a craftsperson, someone who constructs stories. The story is literally a construction, crafted out of words, and if you pull out a single page of 1917, like any other purely sequential story, and suddenly a fundamental link is missing that took you from A to B, or from B to C, or from D to E, that missing page or an alternative page would have to be reintroduced, or the whole structure is going to topple like a Jenga tower without that critical piece. You see, the characters are going to be acting specifically on the last line. It's a continuation. That's the whole nature of sequential storytelling. Whereas in modern screenplays, where cuts are common and scenes are often kept short and sweet, scenes can really often be removed, replaced, or altered without any dramatic impact on the overall structure. Thus, "Pick a man, bring your kit" means Blake and Schofield follow. They get their orders, they set off. Each preceding scene leads into the next and is bound specifically by where the character was, what they may have done, and what options are open to them since the end of the preceding line. It's a form of destiny writ large. Plenty of films that are sequential, that is, do not jump around, but play out in order, still play with time, in ways that often go unnoticed to us as viewers. Almost every moment of sadness is usually extended out for an effect. Here's an example. Two lovers share a glance, the music rising. We're presented with a close-up of her face first, tentative, scared, still slightly relieved that she has been found. Then his face, brimming with emotion and unrequited love, deeply worried because she's in the arms of a 25-foot-tall gorilla. This moment lasts quite a while, and it's just one of an infinite variety of examples. But it came to my mind, it's from Peter Jackson's King Kong. This moment is not only extended for effect, it's actually doubled. Because the first shot is only of Naomi Watts. The second shot is only of Adrian Brody. But they're meant to be happening simultaneously, and weirdly, this is precisely how our brains actually interpret this information. Her reaction, his reaction. But we don't think her reaction, his reaction. We think two people looking at each other. Unless it's actually called out to us that these are two separate cuts. So when you can't cut, you just have this one shot that has to capture everything, and you actually end up communicating much faster. The look, with both characters genuinely in the same frame and running in real time, only needs to last a few seconds, and then it's time to move on. That is not what happens in King Kong. I feel that just that moment seemed to last almost an entire minute. It is a particularly long film, as you might remember. So the screen is already this narrative engine that demands more and more story, but in real time, this effect is heightened. The moments don't last as long as they might in a traditional screenplay. And so you need to fill it with more content. 1917 is actually 120 pages long, which is quite long for a screenplay. This ability to be simultaneous, though, and this demand for more and more action shouldn't be overlooked. It can be a great technique, too, and have its benefits, and I'll explain a bit more about that now that I've addressed the rules and we can start to work through the story itself. So from this point on, there will by necessity need to be some spoilers for 1917. So if you haven't seen the film, I'd stop here and watch it and then come back because I'm going to talk to you about some of the key events in the story that are very exciting when they happen on screen, but probably not as exciting when I talk about them. In the last Writer's Workshop episode on Locke, I talked about the structure really in terms of the characters that interact with Locke, and how the order that that occurs in forms the structure of the story. 1917 is much more concerned as a big adventure across the scarred battlefield of the Western Front with place, the where, as well as the who and the when. All of the secondary characters are essentially waypoints on that journey, and overall, the story structure is much more familiar in terms of a hero's journey. After the introduction, we see Blake and Schofield as they interact as soldiers and friends, chatting and joking casually, until the scene in the dugout that begins from pages 6 to 11, where General Erinmore, Colin Firth, explains the situation and gives them their mission, basically the setup for the film, which is that they're going to try to catch up with the second Devons and deliver the message to call off the attack before it's too late. There's an interesting note to the action lines here. Erinmore speaks slowly, desperate to impress upon Blake and Schofield the gravity of the situation. Nothing can be misunderstood, the screenplay says. Interestingly, that's also true for the writer. You can't be misunderstood by your audience. So we need to be on board with these protagonists to know what they know and to fear what they fear. As I mentioned, this is quite a long screenplay. It comes in at 117 pages total, and a lot of its shape will feel quite familiar, even if the idea of being completely sequential and designed to be in a single shot might be a little different. You would expect to get the mission set out by around page 10. The momentum that carries us to the next big event is both conflict between Blake and Schofield, in terms of just arguing a little about how to handle the situation they find themselves in, and in the conflict they end up having with the other soldiers as they try to move down the trenches. In this way, 1917 is quite like Sam Mendes' other war film, Jarhead, where there is essentially no engagement with the enemy at all. And so most of the conflict comes out within the boisterous nature of the group of Marines themselves. This is something that's quite common to war films. It can't always be about fighting the enemy. So conflict within the group can also give us a bit of momentum and keep the story going in the meantime. One of the more exciting characters that they meet is Lieutenant Leslie, and he is just so cynical about Blake and Schofield's mission that it adds a lot of humor to what is about to become quite tense. His role is around pages 19 to 23 in the screenplay, and it's kind of this key moment before setting off and actually getting up out of the trench. So with all of these scenes that seem to blend into each other, it's also quite interesting how clearly marketed these moments all feel, both on the page and on screen. And I think adding these characters, as I mentioned, like waypoints, it kind of gives us a sense of when each event took place. So even though the characters themselves might not always contribute to the character's development, the main protagonist's development, it still serves as a waypoint. It's a place, it's a moment, it's an event that they get to along the way. Now, after Lieutenant Leslie gives them a flare and douses them with a prayer and whiskey as holy water and shows them the path to take, the next key step of the story is that journey into the unfamiliar world that is a staple of every adventure story. And here's a great place for me to show you how the script handles that transition between key scenes. Schofield takes a deep breath and goes first. He puts one hand over the parapet, then the other. Slowly he advances up, his head inching over the protection of the trench. His hand is shaking. He drives it into the mud, grasping for purchase. Everyone is still, breathless, listening for the enemy to fire. Schofield drags his body up and over into no man's land, continuous. Fast, almost unbearably open after the close quarters of the trench. A light mist hangs low over the land. The ground is treacle-like. Schofield's hands and knees sink into it as he pulls himself forward. His eyes are trained through the British wire to the German lines. The whole world is lunar and empty. Earth pounded to atoms, all mounds and holes. Nothing moves. Nothing lives. Every step of their journey is planned out, written out in pages full of action lines with sparse dialogue. These are the set pieces. And with the big budget and epic scope of 1917, you would expect a few of these. But even the lower budget Birdman has set pieces, and Victoria does too, such as the moment she sits and plays piano for Sonna, the panic attack, the robbery, and so on. So they can be included at any level, just accommodated for based on practical realities. Victoria playing the Mephisto waltz is as engaging a cinema as Blake and Schofield crossing No Man's Land in its own way. Crossing No Man's Land over pages 24 to 28, then there's the scene in the German trenches, which are abandoned, 28 to 37. These are really good examples of how these long sequences also are stories themselves within stories, each bit leading into the next, each action causing and contextualizing those that follow. Because within the larger structure of the screenplay itself, you see, about a fifth or a quarter of the way through, you have the protagonist crossing into the alternative world, the world outside the British trenches, where they're not supposed to be under normal circumstances. But within this sequence, it happens again, because an entire story is told over these pages. So they get across No Man's Land, which is recreated in this stunning and revolting detail, and get into the German trenches, which is another threshold to cross. And with the explosion and the tripwire in the trench itself as a mini-sequence, that has its own turning point and climax. So in this way, 1917 comes to us in waves, with moments of heightened action and moments of rest. Understanding how to build in these ups and downs into a screenplay is a sense of balance that I think we can become attuned to by simply watching and studying numerous examples until we get a good sense of what it is and how to maintain it. It really is a fundamental part of writing, though. The grand finale of this sequence features Schofield being temporarily blinded by the debris of the explosion, which gets into his eyes, and him having to be led out by Blake, which allows Sam Mendes to work in this beautiful parallel to John Singer Sargent's painting of Gast, which shows a line of troops after they've suffered a mustard gas attack. And this blindness was a common feature of World War I battlefields, of course, because of the use of this chemical warfare. The use of gas itself is missing from 1917. Perhaps it would be too much or too insensitive or just not fit into the story, but I did like this as a temporary parallel nonetheless. But yes, maybe next time you watch 1917, think about how these stories within stories are also constructed here and how these sequences blend into each other. So for example, here there is almost a mini act where it's them crossing no man's land, them entering the German trenches, the conversation they have when they see the German barracks, the explosion, and then the escape, and how that forms an entire story in itself, which then is part of the larger whole. The next sequence has Schofield angry, upset, and blaming Blake, but gradually coming back around, and their bond is strengthened as a result of what they've been through. And this is a wonderful quote after they've been talking for a while, which I'm going to have to repeat here as well, which is when Schofield turns to Blake and says, "I hated going home. I hated it. When I knew I couldn't stay, when I knew I had to leave them, and they might never see me." See, this is one of the powers of pacing here. It's waiting for that moment. A lot of the conversations that they have are seemingly mundane, and I think it really works to bring out these key moments when they do open up. Something which naturally feels like it might be quite slow to occur on a battlefield. And then we enter the farmyard scene, which serves as a midpoint. And you all know what I'm talking about with this scene. But to begin with, there's planes in the sky as they're walking down the hill. And this is a great moment here to think about in terms of sequential single-shot filmmaking. And what I mentioned previously about how even though real-time eats up story, the fact is you can tell two stories at the same time, which can be a really interesting technique to include. Another film that does this really well is Hotel Mumbai, which I talked about with John Colley on this podcast. And I mentioned that the director Anthony Maras has a really, really good sense of how you can tell two stories simultaneously on screen at the same time. And that's being introduced here with the farmyard scene and the planes in the sky that they're watching. And that's a story that's also going to unfold, but is happening simultaneously and within the same shot as Blake and Schofield. And another example of how it's done in a more poetic way, let's say, is the screenplay here mentions that Blake and Schofield split up, and Schofield goes into the house to explore, and Blake goes around the outside of the house. Now, in traditional cut cinema, you would show Schofield going through the house, show what he sees, and then cut outside to Blake and show him outside, and then cut back to Schofield. But here, what you have is you follow Schofield, and then you see through the window Blake going outside, and then they talk to each other through the window. What we see here is that it's happening entirely simultaneously. And it's a really subtle technique, but it's important to consider that visual language allows you to have these simultaneous contrasts and comparisons. Very shortly after this moment, the planes reappear in the sky. And I really like the lines here where it says, "The violence is so far removed from him that it looks balletic. Beautiful, even. He moves towards them to get a better look. The planes twist and circle in the air, engines droning and whining as the planes dip and rise." I would say if you can only read one segment of 1917, it should be this one that begins here, with the crash landing, the two of them saving the German pilot from the wreckage of the plane, then Schofield running to get the water. And here as you read it, you'll see that Blake's dialogue is actually listed as being specifically off-screen as Schofield works the water pump. These are harrowing pages, and there's little I can say to do justice to how they're written. But what I will say is there are three big points of learning for us in this section. Number one, saving the pilot is a decision that tells us something about each character. Schofield suggests killing him, Blake wants to help, and that is the fatal decision that undoes him. Point two, this is where the real-time nature of this film is at its most effective. Blake's death is slow, miserable, and the audience is bound by the single camera together with Schofield, watching, unable to do anything to save him. This is one of the biggest strengths of the approach, to force the audience into something painful, claustrophobic, upsetting, with no way to cut away, just witnessing it all. And this death sequence just goes on for such a long time. And that is the reality of it. It's not heightened. It's not slowed down for effect. It's really about something unfolding in real time and how that would go, how that death might be to witness. It's such a powerful effect. And I think it is really, really one of the strongest arguments for why this type of storytelling, this single camera sequential approach, really, really works for the story of 1917. So point number three, this is where it becomes apparent that we have been following a false protagonist. And certainly during the first watch of 1917, it would seem to us at the beginning that Blake is the protagonist. The mission is given to him. It is his brother who is at risk if the message isn't delivered. He is the one who saves Schofield after he's blinded by the explosion. And now after all this agony, he's gone. So to pull off this switch, to really make the false protagonist work, what needs to happen and does happen is that Schofield, the real protagonist, takes on the burden for the one who cannot continue. And I feel this is really, really important. There's very little doubt in our mind that he's going to do anything in order to carry out this mission for Blake. Just as if Frodo had died in The Lord of the Rings, we knew that Sam would have died to fulfill the mission. Maybe getting fully in depth with the false protagonist idea might require an episode of its own, but the simple way to define this rule is the protagonist must complete the goal for the false protagonist who could not. Because we, the audience, have invested an hour already in this story, and we're not going to want it to be switched out for another one now. We want to know how this story ends, not another one. And so this is what I believe a false protagonist actually should be. In order for the switch to be successful, it should carry on the same goal and the same story. It's interesting this moment comes at the midpoint, because Schofield is now the sole protagonist who we will follow for the remainder of the film, and there's still half a film to go. It does feel right to me as a narrative decision, but it might have worked at the end of what you would traditionally call Act 2, or mid-Act 3. Instead, we get the film of two halves, really, and the first half has its two characters, and the second half, it's just Schofield. And that means that what we're going to follow is basically this character, his decisions, and his determination right to the end. So he's very much in mourning, and luckily some other soldiers find him quite quickly afterwards. That is something that's written into it, I think, because it wouldn't make sense without this interruption in order to keep him moving and to keep the real-time thing going. So he's helped by Captain Smith, then transported in an army truck that is constantly getting stuck in the mud, and he's surrounded by these other men, mainly privates, and forced to basically listen into their conversation. And it's a moment that actually is a very clever contrast, because it demonstrates the isolation he's feeling internally at the loss of his friend, whilst being surrounded by others who he barely knows. And so, again, this moment starts to keep him moving, and there's this key moment when the truck is stuck in the mud again, and it's clear his determination to finish the mission is coming through when he's the one just yelling at the others to help and try and get the truck unstuck again out of the mud. So importantly, even though there's been this moment where he's lost hope, where he doesn't know what to do, and he would have retreated inward, it keeps the structure decision-based. And one of the lines that I really love from just the kind of banter, the silliness going on between the privates is another of these moments, again, like the key line that Schofield had talking to Blake shortly before Blake died. This line that just kind of comes out that says, 3 years fighting over this, we should have let the bastards keep it. That line, I think, really rings out as a sense of some of the anger and frustration and desperation that must have been felt during this stalemate of a war that just was going absolutely nowhere after years. Well, by the time the truck reaches the canal, they find the bridge has been destroyed, and we're already at page 73 at this point, and we're about to enter the final sequence. And Schofield has to cross the canal, and he starts getting shot at, and all of this is described in vibrant detail again in a few pages of action lines, that there's very little I feel that I can do in recounting these events that are much more impressive in the film itself. But I will describe how the encounter with the German sniper goes, because this is where the film breaks its rule. One time only, and very carefully. And as we know, rules can be broken, as long as there's a good reason to do so. And at this moment, this one jump forward in time allows the film to turn into night, and that's also going to lead into early morning and create all of this really visually brilliant, dramatic lighting as the backdrop for the final sequence of events. Technically, it's not a rule break either, I suppose, because it doesn't stop meaning it's one shot, because, again, it never really was one shot. But the jump is justified when you think about it, because the story follows Schofield's point of view. And if Schofield is unconscious, then he too experienced nothing in the transition between these two scenes. So maybe that's quite a smart way around that rule. Anyway, I'm going to describe basically how the screenplay handles this. This is when he's just climbed up the steps. He enters the room with his rifle ready, and they both shoot at each other at the exact same second. It says, the German's bullet hits Schofield on the helmet, ripping his neck and upper body backwards, almost lifting him off his feet. Schofield stumbles backwards and falls down the stairs. Bam, he hits a stone at the foot of the stairs, and black. Interior lockhouse night. Still black. In the darkness, the sound of a single drip. Out of the darkness, Schofield's face. The drip comes from a hole in the ceiling and falls on Schofield's forehead. He opens his eyes. You know, it feels so natural in the way it's written. I think that there's something to learn in this moment as well, is when to break your own rules, when pacing demands it, when the story demands it. And I know Sam Mendes has said in interviews about this film, particularly, that he really wanted this to be able to go through the cycles of the day, from daytime into nighttime into morning, and he felt this would be one of the solutions. But aside from that, from a story point of view, it really does make sense as well, I think, to have this moment of rest that isn't really rest, and shock and desperation. To me, it was a really good decision. So largely the next parts from this point forward are very action-based. There's a lot of description, a lot of action lines on these pages, as so often it's only Schofield who is on screen. And so it's just describing a lot of what he's doing. Then there's the intimate repose where he meets the French woman hiding out, still in a coust, called Laurie. She's caring for a baby. There's a sense in this scene that it reminds Schofield of his purpose, and it grounds him again. It gives him some sort of sense of where or who he is and what is going on, not just in the world outside, but also where he comes from, as he recounts the poem The Jumblies by Edward Lear to the baby. And by the end of this scene, when he decides he has to leave, sacrificing this temporary security for the higher duty of the mission, we're already nearing that 90-page mark, and we've just got this last quarter of the film that's going to be really action-packed. Lots of action follows. The escape from Akust, near death, and then his trip down the river, carried by the current, which is broken by the discovery of the company of soldiers, and the singing of the wayfaring stranger in the woods. This is essentially the resurrection moment. That's when night becomes dawn. He survives and is so exhausted that he almost loses track. But then the other soldiers notice him and kind of bring him back. And all of this with that beautiful nighttime cinematography. Roger Deakins, who did a phenomenal, phenomenal job overseeing all of this, and just is such a beautiful sequence. In my opinion, these last 20 pages are majestic, and we get lines like these here. Schofield is running through the hail of bullets and shells, and we remember what that looked like on screen, and it's just this phenomenal, phenomenal sequence at the end. I would say the finale is one of the most beautiful sequences in all of cinema, because you've got this pure heroism of running one way for the right purpose when all others are running in the wrong direction, and that's when the men are going over the top and rushing to their deaths while Schofield is running along the top of the trench and trying to deliver the message. And I think it's beautiful because it honors all of those who died that way, charging into the unknown, our great-grandfather's generation. And this is really the crescendo of Mendes's screenplay here. There is something that needs to be acknowledged here. When I say heroism, you know, it's not really about this heroic charge. It's just, perhaps I can't think of a better word for it right now than that. But it's the fact that essentially so many went to their deaths in this manner, and for so little. And that it's a sacrifice that we want to recall and remember, and not forget why it happened. Because it is such a critical moment, I think, of the history of the world, that so many men died in this mass mechanized warfare. And towards the end, there is a real acknowledgement in this story of how this message that's delivered that will call off the attack, the confrontation that happens with Colonel Mackenzie, really ends on that somber note of, well, the attack is being called off today and something else is going to come. There's three key moments, I think, to address right at the end and that really tie up the story beautifully. That confrontation with Mackenzie, who is played by Benedict Cumberbatch. Brilliant moment of tense drama. And we have that elation, that brilliant moment at the end of the mission has been accomplished. Then we have finding Lieutenant Blake, the brother of Schofield's companion who has died along the way, and him having to tell him about the death, having to watch this man who he's literally just met kind of crumble inside and try and hold it together outwardly. And this is followed by the return, which is this acknowledgement of where we came from, the field, like the opening shot, and Schofield sitting down, looking at the pictures of his wife and his two young girls, which is the first time any of that is revealed. And that, I think, is one of the most important character details in the entire screenplay, and the final moment of learning, really, is Schofield never shares any of these details about his life with Blake. He does mention how difficult it was to go home to his family, but he's not talking constantly about his two girls. He's not talking about his wife. He's not talking about his mother, his father, any brothers or sisters that he has. He's a very inward person. He's very secretive. And I think in that sense, there's a sense of that sacrifice, what he's potentially risking, and what so many people who fought in that war were risking, was often not seen because it was something that was really happening back at home. And the way that life became so expendable on the Western Front in particular was quite horrifying. Anyway, to end on that note, that is everything I can really think of saying about 1917 at this moment. I think it's a screenplay with so many ideas, so many things to learn from, and I really hope I've done it justice by bringing up some of these ideas and hopefully sparking some ideas in your mind about it. If you do think there are some other things that I might have missed, as I mentioned, let's continue the conversation in the comments section on Syncify or on the Instagram account, or just use the website to contact me on the contact page. And as I promised, I would end this episode by sharing with you the two quotations that open the screenplay to 1917 and a little bit of information about them. I mean, it would be fascinating to get to ask Sam Mendes and Kirsty Wilson Cairns why these two were selected above all the other lines and poems that kind of come from this World War I era, a time of some fantastic poets and writers. But these two that were selected are the first by A.E. Housman, which is, "Life, to be sure, is nothing much to lose, but young men think it is, and we were young." That's a poet who didn't fight in the war himself. He was quite a bit older when the war took place, but certainly was an advocate for the poets of the First World War and used his position to really share their experiences. And the second quote is much more familiar, from Erich Maria Remarque, who wrote All Quiet on the Western Front. And the second line is, "We have so much to say, and we shall never say it." And I have no other words to add after that. I think that is something we can dwell on for plenty of time. Again, I think there's plenty to think about in terms of what that means, but the screenplay to 1917 really is an act of remembrance in that sense, and trying to find some words for things that were never said. And I thought it was a very, very powerful thing. I highly recommend you read it, and I hope you've enjoyed my journey back through 1917 with you today. Thank you for listening. Thank you for continuing to support the 21st Rewrite, and I'll see you next time. Thank you very much.